Welcome back, one and all, to HGO Football. We are on the road to the World Cup, and I'm not talking FIFA games, although a few of you may remember that one as well, classic as well, 98. We're on the road to the World Cup. It's on the horizon. Andrew and I are going to be in the hot seat doing a series of World Cup reviews of the last six, seven, eight World Cups. I can't count. My maths isn't that good. But we've got an absolute cracker for you today. We're talking Italia 90. We're joined by a very special guest, Michael Hamlin, or you may know him better as at 80s and 90s football on Twitter. I'm going to throw it to our esteemed guest shortly, but Andrew, you well?
Yes, very well, very well. Looking forward to this chat with friend of the pod. Absolutely. It's great to have Mike join us this evening.
It is, and not just a friend of the pod, but an expert in such an era who will wax lyrical, I am sure. Mike, how's it going, mate? You all right?
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to getting stuck into this one tonight. It's definitely up my street.
Absolutely. I think Italia 90, you know, the name just resounds, doesn't it? Everyone remembers, everyone knows, you know, it's just like, I think, I don't know, maybe it's just the age we are. I think it's just that when you could do a 90 with it, so whether you're talking about Italia 90, you're in 96, France 98, even USA 94, we'll talk about that another time. It just springs a certain nostalgia. And I guess, look, we're going to dive into some classic questions and put you on the spot to name your sort of top player or best goal and a few other ones categories. But before we dive into that, I guess we just wanted to talk a little bit about your overriding memories. First of all, watching it as just a football fan and football viewer, and then a little bit about the legacy that the tournament left football. And obviously, Andrew and I can share our thoughts as well.
Yeah, sounds good.
Go for it. And so you're sitting there, a young Mike. We won't share ages. We're better than that. But you're watching that. You're a football fan. Did you love it? Did you love it watching it as a tournament, or is it something that's grown on you looking back?
No, I was in love with it from the minute it started. You know, that's my first tournament. I think if your first tournament is always your go-to tournament, and it doesn't matter if it's Spain 82, Mexico 86, or USA 94. To me, Italia 90 was my first tournament, and I will defend it against anyone that it's the best tournament. And I know we'll go through the reasons why it is, and there's reasons why it's not so good, perhaps. But I think if you look at the whole package, and I think when you're seven or eight, sorry, I can't remember, but I'm giving away my age here. There's not a great deal of football on TV when I was young. So you look at what was this, 89, 90. It's not a great deal of TV. And all of a sudden you get a month of football on the TV and you're seeing all the best players in the world. You're seeing all these stories and you're getting the Maradona and, you know, the Hullet and Van Basten. I know they're not in the tournament very long, but, you know these, all the star names are there and some perform and some don't. But as an eight-year-old, you're just completely immersed and into it. And it just takes over your life. And I think for me, I my first season I went to football was 88, 89, and it gets, your addiction gets more and more and you get more sucked into it. And I always say that Italia 90 took my love of football to almost the stratosphere. It was just everything I wanted. And I know that people will always moan and groan about the quality of football, and I know we'll probably talk about that. But when you've got nothing to compare it against at that time, you know, you start seeing clips of Mexico 86 and Spain 82. But when you're seeing it live, you've got nothing to compare it with, and it's just the best thing ever.
It's that wall-to-wall TV feeling that I think only a summer tournament. The sad fact is that we're going to be going into a Winter World Cup, which is a conversation for another day, is when we do the preview to this coming World Cup. But that summer tournament vibe, where, like you say, it's three or four matches a day, wall-to-wall on the television or on the wireless, on the radio, wherever you're listening or watching. And it's just that buzz, isn't it? And obviously, I think from a European perspective, the World Cup was again back in Europe, as the name will reveal. And I think for me, the first big World Cup would probably in hindsight have been 94, again, sort of that sort of 7-8 years old. However, England weren't in it. So I grew up, my first sort of visions of football were often canonized videos of Italia 90, you know, being three years old at the time of the World Cup. And sort of the legacy that it left in the UK and in England was not necessarily, like you said, one of astonishing football, but just sort of an unbelievable passion again for the game, following probably sort of a difficult time in the 80s for English football in general. And yeah, so that was my abiding sort of a memory of it as growing up as a boy, was just the impact it had, I guess, on the game in the UK.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I don't think I'm even a year old for this World Cup, so I'm heavily being guided by Mike here. But I mean, a great sales pitch, I've got to say, Mike, for the Italia 90 there. And for the listeners who, we don't obviously do video pods, but behind Mike right now is a wonderful photo of Salvatore Scalacci. So he's definitely not making that up when he said it's just the best ever.
I think we might have to get a screenshot and throw that out when Mike's talking of the Italian. It's a worthwhile background. I think, look, we'll delve into the legacy it leaves a bit more as we go through questions, because I think you're right. And I think what I really want to touch on at some point is the sort of its cultural importance in Europe as well as a uniting force. Obviously, it's no spoiler to say who goes on and wins the World Cup, you know, given it was 32, 33 years ago. But the last time, obviously, as West Germany before the proper reunification, uniting factor again in the UK after the troubles we had in the 80s. But it played that role, and clearly a huge role in the globalization of the game with respect to TV coverage as well, being wall to wall and being everywhere. So we want to delve into that a little bit. But I think we can pick at that and unearth that as we go through some key questions, can't we, Andrew?
Yeah, I did wonder if about before we, you know, just deep dive into one of those, is to get your take, Mike, on the English expectation at the time. So going into this tournament in Italy back in 1990, what were we, 24 years of hurt at that point? what were the expectations for that side after an 86 campaign in Mexico that, you know, wasn't a shame. Shameful performance by no means, but as a fan, obviously you were a young kid growing up, but what, looking back now in hindsight, was this team able to go the distance it did?
I think when you look in hindsight and reflection, I think yes, it could have done, but I think before that tournament, I think the press had written England off, and there was this mass, you know, Robbie Robson had almost been sort of hounded out of his job, and he, you know, they wouldn't renew his contract. So he got a job at PSV, and then the press turned on him for leaving. But, you know, after the Euro 88, where we got, you know, we lost three games and we had that draw against Saudi Arabia and we drew 1-1, and the headlines and the newspaper were all about getting rid of Robson. And I think the press and the fans, I think the expectation was very, very low. And I think if you then dissect the squad and look at the players that we had at our disposal, it's quite clear that we did have a chance. Mm. And I think throughout the tournament, we played very well in some games. You know, the Dutch game, we were absolutely fantastic. And the Germany game, we were brilliant as well. And against Ireland and Egypt and Belgium, we weren't. And I think anyone who goes for a tournament has good games and bad games. And it's, I suppose, the sign of a good team is coming through a bad game and coming through the other, coming out the other end and going through. But I think, answer your question, I honestly think that the expectation was very low, and I think that was shaped by the press.
I don't think we've, I mean, bless him, I don't think we've had a manager that's captured the hearts, really, of so many English football fans since Sir Bobby, really. I mean, we've been long searching for another our Bobby, you know. And I think Harry Redknapp had that feeling, didn't he, for a little while, where fans really were vouching for Harry to have that England job, and it never really materialised. But so who was fancied at the time, Mike? Were Italy the favourites, or were there with Argentina?
I think it was Italy because home World Cup, and at the time, Italy was the epicentre of football. You had Serie A, you had all the best players in the world playing in Serie A, and Italy literally was, as I said, the epicentre of football in the world. And it looked glorious, and all the best players were there. It was great. And I think West Germany, again, they were obviously in with a shout, you know, with Matthäus and Klinsmann, and, you know, runners-up in 86. I know they were semi-finalists in Euro 88. Obviously, you have the Hollands, were widely tipped because obviously Euro 88, they were the winners. They had Hullit, they had Van Basten, they had Rijkaard, they had Koeman. They had a really good squad. I even think the Soviet Union roomed with a shout as well. Again, they were runners-up in Euro 88. You know, I'm very fond of the Soviet Union at that time, so I'm always going to be very biased towards that. I think Argentina, I think, you know, Maradona was still there. I think nobody probably knew how bad Maradona was on the pitch, injury-wise, and how, you know, sort of crocked he was until the World Cup started. But I think just that name instills fear, especially the opposition. Brazil, you know, you always mention Brazil. You know, they weren't the team of 86 and definitely the team of 82, but they were still a name on paper. You know, Spain, always there or thereabouts, but in those days, never delivered. But I think you're probably looking at Italy and West Germany. Mm. And I think that would have been the final. Unfortunately, Argentina ruined that, but that would have been the final, I think, that probably people would have expected.
Mm. Okay. What should we kick off with, Tom, then? What should we go for?
Look, we know the winners. So what about the best player of the tournament? So we're not necessarily about top goal scorer, which is the man that adorns your background. Who were the names that sort of... what happens at a World Cup? And even if you're talking about, you know, you have a James Rodriguez or whatever, who suddenly leaves the World Cup as a global superstar that everyone wants to buy. Who for you were the names that, A, were the best players at the tournament, but B, I guess as a fan, just suddenly came to the world's attention as well? Because that always happens at the World Cup.
Oh, definitely. I think the star players that were obviously supposed to show and shot and turn up and show, if I'm honest, didn't. You know, Van Basten, Zuhulit, you know, didn't perform, as I've said. You know, Buchigano and Francescoli, they just didn't perform. But I think that the player, and this is going to sound biased, but I think Gascoigne just ultimately stands out as a player in that World Cup that announces himself. Mm. Same with Baggio. Baggio, you know, when he scores that goal against Czechoslovakia, and it is literally just, oh my God, you know, he's the world's most expensive player at the time. And I think outside of Italy, you probably didn't know him. I know I didn't. And, you know, he just burst onto the scene and, you know, he becomes, you know, I think he's one of the best players of all time. And, you know, unfortunately, I think he was underappreciated by his manager and kept trying to play Viali. And then he's another player who didn't deliver. And I think, you know, Roger Miller, you've got to talk about Roger Miller in this World Cup.
You've got to talk about Roger Miller.
38 or 37, or could he have been 50? Who knows how old he really was? But, you know, a player...
Was it a personal request or whatever? He was retired, wasn't he? Was he not even playing? And then he came back.
Retired, playing in, I think it was Reunion, it's a French island in the Indian Ocean. And
comes back, gets 3-4 goals, brilliant stuff. And
the Cameroon president basically pleaded for him to come back, and he did. And, yeah, and, you know, that... I think the legacy of African football due to Roger Miller or Cameroon do should never be underestimated in this World Cup. And again, we'll probably talk about maybe a bit more on the legacy, but I think that really put African football on the map.
You're right. And I think they get an extra spot, don't they? The World Cup's moving forward. Again, off the back of the success of Cameroon and therefore Roger Miller and that celebration. So, you know, it changes the course of ultimately of a potentially a continent's footprint at the Football World Cup is, so it can never be sort of diminished. So the impact of those, that Roger Miller and that Cameroon run, those two goals, I think is against Colombia, isn't it? You get that brace or a couple of...
I think Matthias as well. I think from start to finish, he led that team and he was just immense. Absolutely, absolutely brilliant player.
He gets that brilliant goal as well, doesn't he? It's, I think it's Yugoslavia, Matthias. Mm. But
good finish. I mean, Sal, I think Scalacci ended up getting the best player award, I believe. For that tournament, but I mean, you can't look too further than Lothar Matthäus really throughout the whole tournament in terms of the consistency. Again, this is me going off of sort of more extensive highlights and actually living the moment, but no, I think definitely a tournament that a lot of great defenders came out of it well. I mean, Baresi as well for Italy.
Well, let's talk about that, the great defensive piece, because you did say at the top of the call, Mike, and you are quite right that as much as culturally the World Cup is still fated today as having huge impact in terms of the momentum of football globally, particularly in Europe, clearly, and as much as we in the UK and England look fondly back on it as a great World Cup run up until recently was our greatest run in the World Cup since lifting the trophy, clearly. But it is often looked at as a World Cup that didn't necessarily deliver the most attacking or football. I think at the time, Slashik might still have the lowest goals per game. Certainly did for a while. Was that clear? Was that evident? Was it just brilliant defensive displays? Or were you seeing a dearth of creative talent?
For me personally, I was 8 years old, so I wasn't into the tactics much, and I wasn't looking at the defensive style of play. Hmm. I was just seeing it as an eight-year-old who was just completely immersed in football. I think when you look back in hindsight and you look at the rules in play, like the back pass, you could kick the ball back to the goalie could pick it up. And it's almost if you're winning 1-0, how did you ever let a goal in? You just kept playing the goal. You could just keep passing the ball back to the goalkeeper and waste time. And it was within the rules. Mm. And, that obviously changes. And again, this is part of the legacy piece. But you're right. You've got Baresi, you've got Maldini, and, the German defenders were good, like players like that. They were great defenders. And, the art of defending should probably not be underestimated in, like you said. But it's always... it's always the attacking side of things which always people want to see, isn't it? Not so much the defending.
Do you think this was the last World Cup, Mike, where the surprise package was a surprise, and after that we actually were so used to watching and from afar and noticing these talents come on our screens that we don't really, there isn't many players now that your avid football fan doesn't know of some sort. Do you think it was the last World Cup for that, or do you think there was that feeling around 94 as well?
I think 94, probably with Nigeria. I think that the likes of Amakachi and Yakini and players like that, I'd not heard of them, and I'd been 12 then. But I think you're right. It's the last bit of that, that last era of you only knew these players if you had the sticker books and you had the ring binders like I had, and I read everything from that. My August ring bind was like my Bible, and I wish I still had it. And I know there's people on Twitter that still have it, and I'm really jealous of them. But I think you're right that ring binders and sticker books are written 6 months before. So you'll get a player that, like Scalacci, that gets in right at the last minute, or Gascoigne, he has his debut in 89. He really sort of gets his place on the plane against Czechoslovakia in the April. And by that time, all the publications are out. So there is still players that slip under the radar. Roger Miller is a great example. I know he went to the World Cup in 82, but didn't have the impact that he has in this World Cup. And, players like Stojkovic as well. I love Stojkovic. People who know me on Twitter, they know I love Stojkovic and Prosnicki and players like that. And they just appeared out of nowhere. Skiravi is another one, just off the top of my head.
And you still had the feeling of, you may know these players or know of them. But again, seeing them in such detail and seeing them over 90 minutes rather than, rather just hearing or fated news or potentially seeing a goal on a VHS copy somewhere that they've scored to win a cup or win a league title elsewhere, to actually see them so readily and for like a whole month of football, as you say, is clearly a thrill. And again, it's great, but it's also a bit of a shame the way the modern football you can basically be an expert on someone within 30 seconds. It's transfer silly season, as we know, with 48 hours to go to the deadline as we record today. And, if your club are linked to someone, you could have a compilation video of them watching that for 10 minutes within 30 seconds of hearing their name, if you're not quite sure on what they are, good they are. And, it's just a different era, isn't it? And but that's part of the excitement. That's what the World Cup should bring, is new names, new excitement, new spectacle. And I think, it was still brilliant for that, clearly. What was your favourite goal? We're talking about actually going and get the 6 goals and winning the Golden Boot. But what was your personally favourite? What was the favourite and or the best, and do they differ?
My favourite goal is probably Jagan Stojkovic against Spain. I think he scores 2 in that game, but it's the first one where the cross comes over and he drags it back and he sells the Spanish defender a dummy. He's sent out the ground for an ice cream the way he goes flying out. And he then kicks it in the opposite corner by Zubireta. And I'd just not seen things like this before. It was just an absolutely fantastic goal. And I suppose that's my favourite. Is it the best goal? probably Mateus's goal against Yugoslavia, the one where he does that that run where he picks it up and
the run and the drive, low drive.
Could it be Badger against Czechoslovakia? Could it be Badger against Czechoslovakia? But they're both similar goals in the sense of they're sort of driving run, skips a challenge, and then puts it past the keeper. But I'd say it's those three goals for me. And I know that David Platt's goal is very important to me as an England fan.
It's a great finish as well, isn't it? Dropping over the shoulder on the turn. It's a fantastic goal from David Platt.
Definitely, but I'd probably say that my favourite is Stojkovic's.
I'm just watching it now, actually. Yeah, is there shades of Baggio? Yeah,
yeah, the Baggio goal is special. I do like. You know, you've got. I'd like. Is it the first Roger Miller goal? I've just seen it so many times on VHS against Colombia, where he drops a couple of people inside the roof of the net as well. I love that goal. Mm. And obviously, you've got to talk about the celebration as well, haven't you? The corner flag celebration, the jig, the Roger Miller jig is a...
Well, we're all doing that in the playground as an eight-year-old, I can tell you that.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that's what the World Cup does, and that's why it's so special. I imagine playgrounds, that's what international competitions do. Imagine how many playgrounds post Gaza goal 96, how many of them were doing the dentist chair every kid that scored? Do you know what I mean? Bloody hell.
I think, I think that's not a bad shout, because I was just about to say, before you mentioned the Gaza chair, we hadn't seen a better celebration since the Miller one until Papa Bouba Diop in the opening game against France for Senegal.
Yeah,
in the O2 World Cup, which was just fantastic. But I think, yeah, the dentist chair.
The celebrations stick out though, because I know we're jumping World Cups here. I think it's the France 98. Was it Christian Vieri when they all goes and sits down and crosses his arm and it gets there? All the Italians all come and sit cross legged and stuff like that. And I think when you are a kid, you know, whether you're 4, 10, 14 or 20, like, when you're young and you're enthralled by it, the goals and the celebration is what you remember. The other thing that sticks out at World Cups is kits. And we've got to talk about kits when we're talking about 80s and 90s World Cups. And with Mr. 80s and 90s football himself, which kits stand out for you, Mike? Which was your favourite? But there was a few crackers.
I love the England shirt. And that's not just me being patriotic. I do like the England shirt. I think West Germany shirt is a classic shirt. I like the Yugoslavian shirt. But my favourite shirt for Italia 90, and this is really, really off the wall, this one is, and it is the Cameroon away shirt they wear against the Soviet Union when they get beaten 4-0. I don't think many people probably choose that shirt, but that's my favourite one.
Describe it for the listeners, Mike.
We have to tweet it out as well if you find a photo. Yeah. Do you have a replica? Do you have it?
No, not at all. Trying to think, it was the red or the yellow one. I think it's like a red yellow. It's very, very an African type colour one. And
Cameroon away kit 1990. Here we go. Okay. Yeah. So it's what I'm seeing here is that primarily yellow with like a green trim on the shoulder.
It's definitely the Colombia shirt is a nice shirt as well. I like the Cameroon away shirt.
Nice. Didn't think you'd say that. That's interesting. How about your favourite memory of the tournament, Mike? So because there's some real, well, I mean, you could make a top five, couldn't you, of just England moments really in this tournament? What would be your standout moment for you? This doesn't have to be a goal. It could be anything, literally anything. I mean, it could even be the amazing opening ceremony.
Well, we haven't talked about that, have we, actually? And, that was quite a spectacle as a child. I'm going to go a bit off piste here, but I remember watching that, expecting to see Maradona run rings around Cameroon, and it didn't happen. And the Cameroon, they obviously win 1-0. And the massing tackle, you just have to laugh every time you see it. Just the way he takes Caniggia out, and I don't know one football fan who's probably not Argentinian that doesn't actually like that. But I think my favourite moment is probably Gazza doing his Cruyff turn against Holland, and I think almost embarrassing the Dutch, especially embarrassing Ronald Koeman, especially what happened 3 years later in Rotterdam. And I think seeing sort of Koeman not knowing quite what's happened and where the ball's gone, and if only Lineker or Steve Ball could have just stretched a bit further, a bit like Gazza in 96, and we could have scored a goal. But I do love that moment. I think that really was the moment where you think, we've got a player here.
Yeah.
We've definitely got a player.
Mm-hmm. I think this question's a, because you tend to sort of favourite moment, you tend to lean towards your kind of, you know, the more positive sort of actions and events. But there are two that stand out to me. And this is like what Tom mentioned earlier, really, which was bang on about this sort of canonized into our minds of clips on montages as England fans through the years. And one of them would be the Waddle penalty that is skied over. I mean, you just cannot get that out of your memory. It's just a real classic clip, isn't it? Of that just blazed over the bar, the way he hits it over. And the other one would be, Tom and I were talking about this off air, of, you know, Lineker looking over to the bench when Gazza was about to break, have his moment. And to me, that is just such an iconic 2 or 3 seconds of Lineker looking over at the bench, like, you need to watch him. Like, so those would be my two standouts, really, from an England perspective.
Yeah, the Lineker grimace of the, he's going to go. But yeah, Waddle is probably the most famous missed penalty until Baggio does him a favour a few years later. You know, he helps him out, doesn't he? He goes, don't worry, I'll Modric, hold my beer. You know, I'll get that for you.
This is probably a podcast for another day, actually. But there's, you know, those sort of England heartache moments. I'm thinking of the Gazza against Germany in 1996, where his leg isn't long enough. You've got the Waddle missed penalty. And you could maybe a more recent one with like Kane should have passed.
McLaren just holding an umbrella in the rain as we failed to qualify for the Euros.
You could do like a top 10, couldn't you, of England heartbreaking moments.
Was there a match from the 1990 World Cup that stands out, not necessarily for its brilliance, but just for you sitting down there, young boy, engrossed, and just, you know, remembering it like it's yesterday, kind of football match?
Yeah, England Cameroon. That's the answer to that one. A game that sort of swung one way, swung the other, and then back. Just the drama, because there weren't many games that were high scoring in this World Cup. Let's be honest. So a 3-2 was quite a rare game, and you know, I remember when Miller was warming up on the sideline and he's a sub, and you just felt scared, which is ridiculous when you think he's a 38-year-old and all those stories, and you think, hang on a minute. But he came on, and within sort of 5-10 minutes, they were 2-1 up. He won a penalty and he set up Nkiké for their goal. And yeah, it was, and I think in that game, I think Shilton deserves a mention for that game, because he did keep us in that game. I know Shilton gets a lot of bad press about the Germany game and the penalties, but he did keep us in that game.
It's funny, isn't it, that like there are games that just stick out from tournaments that aren't necessarily the finals or the semi-finals, but you just remember them minute for minute early on, you know. So Euro 96, the whole of the Netherlands match as well. What was also, I imagine, classic mullet season. Any crazy hairstyles that were brought to the World Cup in 1990 that people should be looking up?
Well, I had a normal haircut, so that, you know, I had a bowl haircut, probably like we all did.
Buzz cut when you're a little boy, you can have nothing else. Little creek cut, that's it.
But I think Skarabi probably gets special mention for his hair. You know, Waddle, with his hair.
Mullet classic.
Gula and Rijkaard and spitting incident in the hair. That's probably worth mentioning.
Iconic moment as well. The gob in the hair, which is pretty disgusting, but it's still iconic, isn't it?
Absolutely disgusting, but it's
not a spray moment, is it, either? Let's be honest, it's a proper gob. It's not just a spray spit. It's a proper...
It's disgusting, Tom.
It's disgusting. It's horrible.
I'm trying to think of other hairstyles. Tony Miola had a good haircut, the American goalkeeper. He had a great haircut.
And let's take you then to the... Well, let's take you then to the... let's take you to the fateful semi-finals. Both obviously going beyond extra, going beyond the normal time. As an England fan, as a young fan, probably not realizing this is because it gets for a long time. What are your memories of that? Of that, Sammy?
Of that game, probably how we played really, really well. And I think on balance of play, we probably did deserve to win that game. Maybe I'm being biased, but I honestly do believe that. You know, I think, you know, Waddle hit the post, that shot that sort of last minute curves, it hits the post and comes out. You know, he has that shot, which I know, I think the free kick, the referee had blown, but he takes that shot from the halfway line, which Ilkin tips over, which wouldn't have counted. But as a moment, it's just, it's, you know, and you didn't see players, I know Beckham does it a few years later, but you didn't see players do this from the halfway line. It's almost like this is something that Pele would have done. I think, you know, Lineker's goal was deserved. You know, the German goal was so freaky. When you look at a side angle of that goal, and the space between the bar and Shipman's hand is so small, it's so minute, and the ball goes through that gap. And, you know, if Shipman was younger, would he have got back and tipped over? Maybe, but it wasn't to be. But I think the penalties, I've never seen a penalty shootout as an England fan, because I don't know if we'd have one or not, actually. So I didn't think that we would, I didn't think I'd go in there with preconceived ideas like I do now, that we're gonna go out like every single penalty shooter we have now. Oh, that's it, we're out. But it was just a really, really upsetting sort of end. And I think when you look at our penalty takers, you know, Pierce was a penalty taker for Nottingham Forest. You would have put money on him scoring.
Great record and from the penalty
scoring was always supposed to be the fifth taker, but he wasn't in the right place. And you know, Waddle, I don't think had taken a penalty, or he'd only taken a handful. It was just a very sad ending. But I think the other semi-final is probably, in some respects, even more famous.
Tough, talking of the penalty shootout, Mike, there. I mean, a really tough decade for England fans. I mean, 90, 96, 98, all ending in penalty heartache, right? 3 in 1 decade, that's got to be a record, surely.
And not even get to the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think it was England-Colombia in 2018. I missed the Spain one. I didn't see the England-Spain game in 1996.
Yeah.
Well, I've never actually experienced a penalty shootout win as a fan until 2018. And it's a very long time. A very long time not to win. And obviously, we followed it up, you know, against Italy and went and then back to normal form, you know, last year.
Absolutely. And as a young fan, you've just seen, obviously, heartache. England have gone out on penalties on the biggest stage of all. Did the World Cup finish there for you? Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, as a young lad, or do you remember the final vividly?
I think I did watch the final, but it was so bad. I think as a spectacle, it ruins that World Cup because, you know, Argentina, I don't like the phrase or the word shithousery, but I think you have to say with Argentina in this World Cup, it is the definition of that word. The way they played, the way they argued and shouted and surrounded the referee. And this game was no exception. And, you know, two players and one player sent off? And then, you know, the penalty probably actually was a bit iffy, but I think the referee had enough and was just like, oh, I've had enough of this. And I think probably every fan around the world, apart from an Argentinian, would have agreed. And, you know, after knocking Italy out and knocking Yugoslavia out and knocking out some good sides through penalty shootouts and playing really, really negative football, I think justice was served because I think Germany probably were the worthy winners of that World Cup overall.
I don't think we could get through an Italia 90 pod, Tom, without talking about two things. One, the logo, because it's an absolutely epic logo, arguably, the best World Cup logo ever. Screams of Gazzetta dello Sport to me, that logo. The colours, a fantastic logo. And also the World in Motion as well.
Again, this is about the culture piece we wanted to talk about. I mean, just to comment quickly on the finals. Finals are very rarely good, but in general, whether it be a cup finals or World Cup finals, but you're right, that was poor. for slightly younger viewers, maybe, although you still have to be, what, 15 plus, I was thinking sort of like, you know, the Chelsea United 2007 FA Cup final, which was just so dire, 1-0 in extra time. But it's just, it felt like that, just raining all day. But you're right, from a cultural perspective, you know, we, again, that's another point. Maybe part of this series, we need to talk about the best logos, the best mascots, and the best World Cup songs, because you've got two fantastic candidates there. And yeah, I mean, the song is just iconic, isn't it, Mike? It's got, is it your favourite football song?
It's my first ever single I ever bought.
Buying
that in Woolworths.
On that night.
Yeah, it's still the best football song. It's better than Three Lions, in my opinion.
It's an absolute banger.
That's absolutely brilliant. You know, any tournament that comes out, that's played in my back garden, that's played in the car, windows down. Yeah, it's an iconic song.
Mm. Yeah.
And so the World Cup's finished. Germany have won it for the third time. Formal reunification, just I think a few months later, literally. Mm. But that in itself leaving a legacy. But you wanted to touch on legacy beyond. And I think, you know, well, you can chunk it up however you want, but there's definitely a football legacy that's left and impacts and pervades English and European football, but also sort of a cultural one, isn't there? So I think it's just for that reason, you made the bold claim at the top of the pod that it was your favorite / the best World Cup ever. This is your chance to valiantly go into bat and battle to say why.
Your closing speech, Mike.
We can delve into it, but yeah, your closing thoughts as to why this leaves a legacy like no other.
Thank you. I've really got to talk this one up now, haven't I, guys? I've been thought about this question quite a lot recently, and I think you have to almost divide this into two. So I think if you look at what happens on the pitch and just on the football pitch, I think that it was a very dire World Cup with only, I think it's 2.2 goals per game is the average. There's the higher percentage of 1-0s. It's a World Cup that's renowned for many great goals and many great games. And that I openly admit, and I can't argue that. There's some great moments, but overall, I can't argue that. But I think from that, in terms of legacy, I think then the back pass rule comes not long after this as an attempt to make football more attacking and trying to make it less defensive. So you can't keep passing the ball back to the goalie. You can pick it up and waste 10 seconds. You know, they've now got to learn to play with their feet. And I think I think Higuita in this World Cup was ridiculed, but actually I think he was ahead of his time. I think that it was almost like one of the first sweeper keepers. You saw him getting the ball outside of the box with his feet, trying to pass it. I know he gets done by Miller, and he starts doing keepy uppies, and he starts doing all these skills, which, you know, as English goalkeepers, you didn't see them do that. You know, you'd see the likes of Seaman, John Lukic, and players and goalies like that, you know, pick up the ball and waste time. And so I think the back pass rule, you know, comes in after Euro 92, but I think that that's a big part of Italian 90's legacy is the back pass rule. I also think that the change of, you know, there used to be 2 points for a win, which then becomes 3 points for a win at USA 94, where before you could draw three games like Ireland did and Holland did and qualify for the next round as a little best third place team. You know, now there's an incentive to get a win, which again means you've got to try and score a goal. And so I think that's another legacy from this World Cup. You know, tackles from behind gets outlawed not long after. I know that, you know, Van Basten had to be the sacrificial limb, or the player who, you know, has to die almost on the pitch to make other players survive almost going forward. And the offside law gets tweaked as well, where before you had to be behind the ball and then it was level. And now, you know, the offside law seems to change its week now, doesn't it, with VAR? You know, what is it? Is it a finger? Is it a foot? You know, what is it? But I think from a legacy point of view, this World Cup starts rule changes for the better, which are now commonplace in today's game. And I think that, you know, yes, you could say Spain 82 and Mexico 86 are better on the pitch and the games are better and all that stuff is true. And the rules were the same. So they could have played, you know, more defensive or boring football, and they didn't. But I think this is the World Cup that it was almost like things have got to change. And I think at the time you get to USA 94, you probably see the benefit of far more attacking play and some superb goals and some superb moments in that World Cup.
Mm. That's really interesting. I didn't think of it in that way before about the whole back pass rule as well and the offside, like you're mentioning there, really, the early signs of change, you know.
Quite sweeping ones, considering, you know, football has been, as we know, hundreds and hundreds of years old, and it feels like hundreds and hundreds of years for any change to be made, let alone so many fundamental changes to the game in such a short space of time. So I think you're right. And it's very interesting, actually, if you took sort of Italia 90 and USA 94 as a direct comparison, just a very different feel and vibe around the whole tournaments, about what they stood for and the way they were marketed. And I think the marketing and the televisation is actually another legacy for me that does stick out massively from the, you know, look at in the UK, birth of the Premier League, you know, season after. I think you're seeing just that again. That look, is that because of Italia 90, or is it just because technology was going to mean that it's going to happen anyway? The truth is probably the latter, but it's certainly the watershed moment, isn't it, where, you know, it's football hitting the world screens in a big way. And obviously what would come in the next 10, 15, 20 years is what we'd then eventually see today, which is just wall-to-wall television. It's global access to the game. It's absolutely everyone indulging in the game. I still think it's one of the most watched World Cups ever, though, isn't it, Italia 90, even though potentially wasn't the scope the greatest scoring. I think over 26 billion views. I mean, that's just crazy, isn't
well,
it?
Across the
tournament.
And all those eyes on that tournament as well, Tom, from a commercial standpoint, you know, we see 2 years later the birth of the Galazzo on Channel 4.
Yeah.
So there's already that interest in Italian football. So they capitalise on that Channel 4, don't they? You know.
Yeah, exactly, and to mass audience, and frankly, they in the UK for English football fans, they probably capitalise again on the country being interested in football, not necessarily seeing it as just something that is for the working class and with the negative connotations around hooliganism and stuff like that. And I think, you know, again, it's that cultural piece, isn't it? Like you said, Lazo on Channel 4 with coffee outside of a fancy coffee shop. Do you know what I mean? Like that is the panache of an Italian World Cup that's brought to our stage, as opposed to a boozer somewhere in a fight, which is potentially the image of football that might have pervaded before, which would have been incorrect, but nonetheless a pretty powerful one, I think. Any other
characters? Can I add to that, Tom?
Yeah, go for it,
I think that you're quite right. I think the visual of that World Cup with the stadiums, you know, the San Siro was like something it was like a spaceship. You know, if you're used to terraced grounds in England, you know, I was used to, you know, my local one, people probably know I'm a Brighton fan, and the Goldstone Ground. And you start seeing, you compare the Goldstone Ground and San Siro, this just pulls apart. You can't compare the two. But you see what football could be, you know, with the stadiums. And the redesign. So when you then start getting the new stadiums that are built throughout the 90s, you get you almost get a blueprint of this is what football can look like stadium wise. But even the TVs, the TV graphics at the time were just different class. You know, when you started getting the flags waving on the screen, and when there's a substitution and the name disappears off the screen and the new guy that's coming on comes from underneath the screen, and you see them sort of like swap places, and you start getting sponsor names around the side of the TV. So from the commercialization of the game, I think it's the first, you start seeing green shoots of what the world's going to become in terms of the stadium, the look, the TV, as I said, the commercial. I do not know one kid that didn't have a Coca-Cola ball, Italia 90 Coca-Cola ball, around this World Cup. I think I had three or four, and I think my next door neighbour probably ended up having all of them and never gave them back either. But, you know, and you're right, you mentioned about the mascot as well, and, you know, the iconic mascot. Before, it was always sort of characters like an orange with a hat on, or, you know, some sort of animal that's been characterised. And all of a sudden now it's a sort of stick man in an Italian flag, which I'm going to show you on the back of my T-shirt if I can. So, you know, I've got my Chow t-shirt on for this as well, so, you know, very special. So, you know, 32 years, you know, I wear this around Tesco's, you know, come on.
Absolutely. No, you're right. You're right. And we also, this is another chat for another day, which is why we love talking to you, Mike, is because I'd love to talk about the best and the best football memorabilia of down the years, stuff that you own, we can share. I've got a load of goodies as well. And that will, you know, but you're right. It's all that. It's like, yes, it's cashing in on that, but it's also just awakening to the fact that it's new and exciting, isn't it? This global thing that people are witnessing. And that's why, I think you're right. Italian 90 stands out there as an absolutely iconic World Cup, which may not go down as many people's best, but it goes down, I'm sure, as a lot of people's favourite. And I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah. I think it's probably a chance just to sort of plug a previous episode here, Tom, when we were lucky enough to have Jonathan Grade on, weren't we, who sort of helped produce the Galazzo show in the 90s. And we had a great chat with him. I'd encourage listeners to go back and find that in the annals. And he spoke very, you know, articulately about the colours of on the screen and the big flags that you were alluding to a minute ago, Mike, and how that went down as such a huge hit with the viewers as one of the main take homes, really, just that the vibrancy of the screen. So
absolutely, and the vibrancy will continue in earnest in the next World Cup review, because you can't get much vibrant. More vibrant than a USA 1994. So that will be a different conversation, a different legacy, trying to break new ground there, but certainly vibrant.
Diana Ross and all.
Absolutely. actually, we spoke about the Waddle miss and the Baggio misses, arguably the most iconic penalty misses. That's got to be up there as well. The Diana Ross one in the opening ceremony as a penalty miss. He should, yeah, you know, the goal should explode.
You wouldn't have her on pens again, would you?
Absolutely not. Well, mind you, for England, I think it would have taken. We were so short on good options, and you could argue still are. Mike, look, as ever, absolute pleasure, mate.
Thank you. No, thank you for having me on. No, I've got honoured to be able to talk about my favourite World Cup. I feel very honoured.
No, we'll continue the 90s chats. And continue to have you on as a regular. Andrew, you enjoyed that one?
Yeah, definitely, very much so. And obviously, we've already touched on the next one. Looking forward to that, the USA throw a party. So,
absolutely. Stay tuned. Tune in still. 80s and 90s football and at HDO Football. And we'll speak to you soon.
Take care, guys.
Cheers. Thank you.